Hi everyone, this is Tim. This podcast is about something that's not very nice, but it's something which I feel as a history teacher, a human, someone who's interested in ethics, someone who's been to the site of Auschwitz-Birkenau, and someone who's interested in why people behave in what might be considered evil or appalling ways and the reasons behind that. I've edited this podcast and what I've written a few times. I'm still not completely happy with it, but I think that's just the nature of the topic, because I am going to be discussing the Holocaust. I've just alluded to Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is one of the three sites that were at the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland, about 90 minutes drive from Krakow. This is an important thing because survivors of the Holocaust are soon no longer going to be with us, and in a post-truth world where we have people even in the Western world like Trump and Johnson, truth is a valuable thing which may well disappear from public discourse in the near future, and I'm really hoping that it doesn't. So here's my contribution to things. I wrote this essay in 2020. I'm going to be reading most of this. And it's been an issue I'd wanted to write about for 8 years after I first visited Auschwitz. As I went into the second camp of the complex for the first time, I felt a feeling of horror, or as if the souls of the dead were screaming out to me. It was almost a religious experience. I've tried to get my head around what I felt and the significance of Auschwitz ever since. I am no expert. I'm a history teacher, an average one, and someone who has read a fair bit of history relating to the Second World War and the Holocaust within it. I've seen a lot of films and documentaries too. Please forgive me my inaccuracies and oversimplifications and what you may deem to be overly subjective experiences and aims. Also forgive my ignorance of things that I have missed or omitted or not heard about, and my limited writing. I aim to put the Holocaust front and centre of history. My guide said to the group I was with on our second day at the site that we do not learn from history. He is right. For the Jewish people who died, and for the other groups who died, the Holocaust and the spectre of Auschwitz needs to be remembered. Some challenge its occurrence. Some seek to dismiss it. Some look to ignore its lessons. We have Holocaust Memorial Day in the UK once a year. Long may that continue. History is not just about the past, it's about who we are today and the lessons we must learn for the future. Most of all, we remember those that suffered and died. So that was my intro to this essay. The essay is incomplete, but I just don't feel I'm ever going to get to a complete stage with it, so here it goes. When I'm not reading, I'll say this is me speaking, and then I'll say back to the essay. Part 1, Auschwitz, Symbol of Horror. I remember watching The Silence of the Lambs when I was a child. There is a scene where Hannibal Lecter crucifies one of his guards on the exterior of a cage he was being imprisoned in. I don't know why, but that scene has always been there in my subconscious, and it often pops up at strange moments. The crucifixion. Maybe the symbolic significance of it is deeply impressed upon my mind. I'm not a religious person in any extreme way, and if you ask me whether Jesus was brought back from the dead, I would probably say no. But for some reason, this scene from the film is deep in me. When I first saw the gate to Auschwitz II, Birkenau, I felt something similar. For that gate and what it symbolises is also deep in my subconscious. And it was only when I first went there that its significance impacted me. It was late in 2012 or 2013. I've been back 2 times since. The word Auschwitz is a Germanized version of the word Oswiecim. Apologise for any pronunciations. A Polish town about 90 minutes drive from Krakow. It is 30 miles west of Krakow in central southern Poland. It was a small fishing village before the Second World War. Today it is associated with one of the greatest horrors in human history. While some may argue that the Holocaust was not just about the death and concentration camp at Auschwitz, for me it is the heart of the body of the Holocaust. It is the site of the murder of between 1 and 2 million people, mainly Jews, whose crime was to be Jewish or to be considered from another racially inferior group. For the people who still live in Izvicin, it is still their home, a place of family and love. The area itself should not be tarnished, but what happened there is a universal lesson. I was on an educational trip for history and RE teachers from the UK. I was with people I had only met the day before. We had been to the Museum of the Occupation at Oskar Schindler's old factory. Schindler saved around 1,200 Jews from the gas chambers by falsely claiming they were essential workers. It was a suitable site to have a museum about the Nazi occupation. We also went to the preserved section of ghetto wall that had once separated the Jews inside from the world outside, and also to a Jewish synagogue. None of this was to prepare me for Auschwitz II Birkenau and that feeling as I approached. Auschwitz was built as three separate camps. Auschwitz I, a former army barracks, and Auschwitz II Birkenau, especially built, and the now destroyed Auschwitz III, which was comprised of factories where the unfortunate workers were exploited. Upon approaching Auschwitz I, I did feel some trepidation, a strange feeling. I knew I was ultimately safe, but I had a strange feeling that I cannot explain. As I entered Auschwitz I, the Arbeit macht frei sign mocked us from above, work will set you free. I thought about the many thousands, hundreds of thousands who had walked through that gate at Auschwitz I and had died there, or nearby at the second camp. Here I was looking to learn, to experience, walking on land that in another time meant certain death. The psychology of the camp system was to give people hope while working them and then destroying them. How cruel. And here I was, effectively a tourist, about to embark on a profound and life-changing experience. I would return to Camp 1 later on. The night after Auschwitz 1, we stayed in a hotel just over the road. After dinner, we went back for an evening class at Camp 1, and then went to bed. After breakfast, we boarded a coach for Auschwitz-Birkenau, Camp 2. I did not realise how close the two sites were. We turned a couple of corners, and then out of nowhere, very suddenly, the gate of Camp 2 rose before me. I froze. I literally froze. My hair stand on end, even as I write this. "My God," I whispered. I had read about this place, watched documentaries and films about it, studied and taught the Holocaust as a history teacher. It had always interested me as a topic that all people should know about. But seeing this gate etched into my subconscious, a symbol from a land far away, a symbol of death and genocidal hatred, pathological hatred, was here before me. A place, a real place in time and space. A place where real people died and real people killed them, methodically, with calculation, diabolically. A gateway etched into my mind, the concept of hell in four dimensions. A gateway to hell itself, here in front of me. We parked and got off. Watchtowers, fences, scale, such huge scale. Camp 1 so small, Camp 2 a gigantic site. Our guide said it was 20 times bigger than Camp 1. It all seemed so quiet in Camp 2. They say the birds don't sing here, or that there are no birds. I did not see any or hear them, but maybe my mind was elsewhere. As we entered, there was a group not far from the gateway. Our guide told us it was a Jewish group. They had Israeli flags. They were wailing and moaning, and quite a few of our group were wondering what was going on. "They are praying," our guide told us. Some of the group were kneeling and swaying in their devotions, including by the wagon that was on display, one that was typical of the ones used to transport so many to the camps. Many died in the wagons themselves. It is estimated that 6 million Jews and 5 million other minority and ethnic groups died in the Holocaust. This was 80% of the European Jewish population. For Jews, Auschwitz is a place that symbolises genocide. It is estimated that between 1 and 2 million died at this site alone. At first it was holocaust by the bullet, with Einsatzgruppen or death squads that shot Jews and others, including local communists or community leaders, in woods or places near towns and villages. Often, locals were happy to comply with the gathering of Jews and others, and even to take part in the brutality. In my youth, I remember being chased by other youths or being kept against my own will in an area of a park or something by some bullies. That feeling of losing control that you often associate with a neutral place even years later. And here we are at a place of death. Once an unknown fishing village with a Polish name, now a former German named death and work camp. Now people can walk around in it freely, listening and looking and thinking. But then, back then, a death sentence for 1 million+ souls. This same fence and that destroyed gas chamber, now seemingly harmless, but still shaded with horror. It was when I stood next to the lonely cattle wagon that it hit me. The track ran into Auschwitz II and split into two. One terminal on the main track and the other a side track. Next to this train track, prisoners were unloaded. Some would have died on the journey from all over Europe. The camp was at the confluence of a network of train tracks from across the continent. In winter, people would have frozen in those trucks. In summer, they would have baked. As we stood next to the wagon, our guide told us that this was where the selections took place. The people who were unloaded had their possessions taken by guards and were told to form a line. With a gesture in either direction, the selector pointed to the left, to work, or to the right, to the gas chambers. Those who went to the right would be dead within minutes, dead in the most terrifying and horrible way. Those going to the left averaged 3 months of slow death. What hit me was the actuality of the place, the banal ordinariness of it all, the matter of fact of it all, the fact that many did this kind of things to many others, unloaded them, selected them, killed them by omission or commission, following orders, groupthink, as a result of propaganda, whatever. Here was a part of the world, real and plain, not a film or a book or a memory or a voice, but a place. And I am stood here and I just don't understand how this thing happened. How could they? The philosopher John Gray in his book Straw Dogs points out how regularly and often in human history the horrible and brutal things can happen. As a teacher, I have often asked a student why they have done something particularly nasty or brutal, and they often cannot find the words to express it. Humans are full of many personalities. One also needs to turn the focus on oneself from time to time. What would we do in such circumstances if we had children and families? How much easier would it be to follow orders? There is an interesting historical debate concerning the development of the Holocaust as to whether it was Hitler's intention all along to destroy the Jews, as he wrote in Mein Kampf and said publicly in 1939. This debate ties in with the issue of who is truly responsible. With a war on, things can get very, very different. I often remember a stoic and tough former German soldier on the fantastic World at War series from the 1970s. He dismisses the Holocaust with a shrug, using the war as an excuse. Certainly the war radicalised the whole situation and meant that millions of undesirable Jews and others were in need of being dealt with, as the Nazis saw it. Jean-Marie Le Pen, French nationalist leader, once said that the Holocaust was just a detail of history. I also recall the superb TV series Nazis, A Warning from History from the 1990s, made by Lawrence Rees. A Nazi called Fridolin von Spohn defends Hitler, saying that when his eyes met Hitler at a public event, he saw in Hitler's eyes good intentions. A few years ago, I was looking for a swastika on the internet for a PowerPoint I was making on the Nazis, in my role as a history teacher. I happened upon a pro-Nazi and pro-Hitler thread based in the United States. People were calling the Führer a great man. The Holocaust is not just a historic event. It is very much an issue that runs at the very heart of the world today. Populism is on the rise as I write this in 2020. Racism, anti-Semitism, war, populism, the threat to liberal democracy are live issues. Although war is never an excuse, it is a factor which must be considered. Wars create situations where the real rule book, whatever that is, goes out of the window. Atomic bombs, fire bombs, civilians starve to death, mass murder, death squads, work camps, death camps, gassing. Some of these horrors were also done by the winners, the good guys and the writers of history. Can we really say that some of these crimes are worse than others? To gas people, to starve people to death, to reduce people to charcoal and atomic dust. Whether one can rank these things or not, one might argue that some of these terrible events from World War II were only made possible by technology that others might have used in the past if able to. The winner's justice of the Nuremberg trials was careful to focus on events that were exclusive to the Nazis. What of the 400,000 Chinese bayoneted at Nanking? Is this any less severe than the Nazi death squads, Einsatzgruppen, that carried out the Holocaust by bullet phase from 1939 until the Holocaust by gas phase that started in 1942? Here it is important to lay some very clear differences. The gassing was an attempt to eradicate a race, to eradicate certain peoples and groups. It became a pathological obsession that was stepped up even when the war was being lost. It became the raison d'etre. The mindset of these things is hard to get one's head around. It almost became a suicidal formalism, a necessity. I remember reading about Hitler's final testimony that he dictated to his secretary in his bunker in April 1945. The note was ridiculous. In it he said he had done his best to eliminate world Jewry. That pretty much summed it up. His whole plan, pretty much. How pathetic. Part 2, hiding the evidence. The Nazis started to keep the reality of the Holocaust away from the majority of the people. Many knew exactly what was going on. Some resisted, some did nothing, and all points in between. I recall an interview with a German who lived opposite the train station where many Jews were deported. What could we do? He asked, saying that to resist meant losing your job or being sent off to a camp yourself. In her book of 1963, Eichmann in Jerusalem, the German-American reporter and philosopher Hannah Arendt coined the phrase, the banality of evil, to describe the apparent normalness of some of the key people involved in the Holocaust. In this case, Adolf Eichmann, mastermind of the transportation system to the camps. The phrase following orders took on a new meaning. People were expecting evil in that courtroom. Instead, people got a mirror up to themselves. These were just average types, caught up in something. Arendt, who had escaped Nazism not once but twice, a German Jew herself, was heavily criticised by many who were intent upon finding evil among Hitler's executioners. In life, we often find ourselves judging people based on crossing a line. A person is a bad person if they cross it, and then we look to prosecute them and throw the book at them. It makes things easy for us, this binary definition, this line. How easy it is to consider an evil bureaucrat and as clear an anti-Semite as Adolf Eichmann as the definition of evil. Arendt had many reasons to find this so. Instead, she saw a pathetic man, an ideological Nazi, who became embroiled in a war where his strengths and organisation went toward facilitating the greatest evil in history. Tribalism, the hatred of the other, a fundamental aspect of our reptilian brains, but yet one we might consider as something that rationalism and higher ideals can transcend. Here those who were different, dehumanized and reduced to nothing, were processed for work and death with ruthless efficiency, with barely a flicker of apparent concern. The horrors of the Holocaust do prompt the question as to what we would have done. I often find myself judging people whom I meet or work alongside with. What would this person have been like during the Holocaust, in reference to their ruthlessness? Maybe I am being unfair. The Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram Experiment, despite their limitations, reveal how normal people can often assume a role and can follow orders from an authority, even when it appears that innocent people might well be damaged or killed. This is me speaking now. The Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram Experiment basically were two experiments where people assumed roles of prisoners and prison officers in a prison, and they had to stop it early because people were getting a little bit too into the roles, as it were. It's been criticised, that study, but the Milgram Experiment showed how about 50% of people, when told to do something by an authority, did it, even when it was likely that someone else was being hurt, possibly to the point of losing consciousness and death. But you can find out about those yourself. Back to the text. When the Soviets took the camp in January 45, they found the place largely deserted. A few remained. The gas chambers had been destroyed. The guards had left, taking the inmates still able to move on death marches to Germany. Weakened by disease, hunger and physical and mental abuse, those who could not go on were shot. Those who arrived in Germany were treated brutally until the bitter end. In the death throes of the Third Reich, the ideology of death and inhumanity were applied rigidly, akin to those who followed the words of a dying evil king to the letter, seemingly oblivious to what was to come later. Many survivors of the camps died in the hours and days and months and years that followed, their bodies and minds never able to recover. Others were to die by suicide, plagued with survivor's guilt. The spectrum of experience and memory was diverse and barbed. Some moved on, others did not. Some forgave, others could not. Some buried it deep in themselves. I've spoken to three Holocaust survivors. Each spoke in a different way about different things. One had escaped to England and avoided the camps. Two others had lived in Auschwitz. One was still very angry, deeply angry. Another, a Soviet woman, spoke of forgiveness. Who is to say what is the correct response? Some of the Sonderkommando, the ones in the camps given promotions to safe jobs, just above the doomed in the hierarchy of the camp, took photographs of women being undressed for the gas chambers. Some of them conspired to sneak them out of the camps at great personal risk. Eventually the Sonderkommando, the ones who removed the bodies from the gas chambers, who sorted the luggage of the arrivals, ended up dead in the same fashion as the others. They had seen too much, and every few months they were exterminated. They knew their fate, but as witnesses to hell itself, they knew that there was something noble, if such a word can be used, something virtuous and just and right, in recording what they saw as evidence of these practices. To get this out to the world, for the world must do something to stop this, surely. And yet evidence of the Holocaust was not directly acted upon by the West. Some in the West argued that the best policy was to cut the head off the Nazi hydras in other places and stop it convincingly in that way. The war was full of atrocity. Winning it offensively was key. The Holocaust was viewed as an inhuman atrocity in an inhuman international theatre of war. Like today, international policy is often taken in the best interests of the powerful nations, rather than an objective analysis of state crime. The death throes of the Reich produced the death of its leaders by poison and or bullet. All was to be staked on the ultimate victory. No other future was possible. Others made it to the Nuremberg trials, a court selected to bring justice by new structures set up after the events. Any crimes of the winners were written out. The pernicious and unprecedented evil of Nazism was to be the full focus. A victim defeated, an easy target, but certainly a worthy one. The camp commander of Auschwitz, Rudolf Hess, a person often accused of being borderline psychotic, was executed at Auschwitz I in 1947, facing the camp by a specially constructed Polish tribunal. Hess's evidence in his writings about Auschwitz are possibly the biggest rebuttal and challenge to the ridiculous and pathetic Holocaust deniers. Hess was brutal, detached and ruthless. He was also someone who took pride in doing his job as efficiently as possible. Much like Eichmann. If one goes to Auschwitz I, the gallows used are still erected outside the perimeter, not far from Hoss's own house. The Israelis went as far as to kidnap Eichmann from Argentina to bring him to trial in Israel. It was a very dangerous operation, but he too was executed. There is still a big debate as to the extent that the German people and those who were non-Jewish in the occupied territories allowed or permitted or went along with it all. The reality is very complex. There are many that resisted and helped Jews and others persecuted. Many who did little or nothing, and many who actively supported the Holocaust. One thing that is certain is that the Holocaust was not publicly discussed or acknowledged by the Nazis. The rhetoric of Jewish persecution and destruction was public, and for many there was no doubt about what was really happening, even if the details were somewhat murky. Some even say that the Jewish authorities in the ghettos were also responsible for helping with the evacuations of the ghettos to the camps after the war was extended into the Soviet Union. Suddenly the persecution and work camps were not enough. 4.5 million Jews from Poland and now the Soviet Union could no longer be herded to special areas and left to die slowly in ghettos while still theoretically working to support the war effort. In January 1942, a special meeting was held at Wannsee, not far from Berlin, to discuss the final solution to the Jewish problem. The armies of the Reich were soon stretched deep into the Soviet Union and were being held up at Stalingrad, Leningrad and Moscow. Reinhard Heydrich, a highly educated Nazi, was given the job of coordinating the final solution. The strange lure of Hitler in persuading so many generals and intelligent people to his will is another ongoing debate among historians. Why did people follow what this strange man said? Heydrich was to organise the gassing of Jews from the expanding Reich Empire. It would not be formally written down, and it was not to be discussed openly. The logistics of organising the death squads, the Einsatzgruppen, in the occupied territories was proving too difficult and too damaging to the exterminators. The death squads were also operating at different levels of extremity and barbarity. Consistency and control was needed. Many Jews and communists faced death at the hands of locals who used the Nazi occupation to score settle and to prove to the new bosses that they were no fans of the Jews or communists either. The Wild East was not a pleasant place. The public response to the euthanasia killings carried out on those with disabilities by the Nazis in Germany earlier in the war had led to their suspension in 1941. Hitler did not want anything similar to stop his final solution. It is estimated that he gave orders for this in late 1941, possibly to Himmler, and the Wannsee Conference was to finalise it. The war of annihilation in the East was to shroud the Holocaust within the fog of war. As mentioned earlier, Hannah Arendt, when reporting on the trial of Eichmann, made a gradual realisation. Eichmann, the man of true evil, the facilitator of Operation Reinhard and the gassing of the Jews, named after Heydrich, was just a banal job's worth in the wrong place at the wrong time. He had a role to play and he did it, following orders, and seemed to believe that he had done no wrong. He just did what he did to the best of his ability. And end called this the banality of evil, for daring to suggest that Eichmann was not Lucifer himself, she was castigated by many around the world. That point's being repeated. This is me speaking now. Back to the text. I feel that my own journey has not really led me to a better understanding of the Holocaust. I feel in many ways like Aaron did. I have read, I have meditated, I have researched into it, but all that is left is a hole. Yet the Holocaust stands there as an event beyond description. There are truly no words. As one survivor put it, Auschwitz was like no place on earth. Yet it happened, and human beings like you and me were part of it. We should learn from it. Every year, Holocaust Memorial Day, it's the 27th of January in the UK, aims to put the events of 33 to 45 front and centre, also in the context of other genocides in history, including genocide that continues in the world today. And we should apply what we learn to today's world, as we too easily forget the lessons of history. And what are these lessons? How and why have we not learned them? Where does one even begin? There is an excellent book by Deborah Lipstadt called Denying the Holocaust, which is now being sold under the name Denial, after the film made in its honour. It is about the libel trial brought by David Irving, a Holocaust denier, in 1996. He unsuccessfully sued Penguin Books Limited in an attempt to use English law to make Lipstadt and Penguin prove that he had, in fact, distorted evidence, as Lipstadt had claimed. The law in the UK made it a perfect place for Irving to put the onus of proof on the other side. The Holocaust was what was really on trial here. Irving was adamant that it was far less severe than had been made out, was not coordinated centrally, and that gas had not been used systematically at Auschwitz. He knew his stuff, and he was also keen to get eyewitnesses up and get them tripping up over details. Irving represented himself. Ultimately, this would lead to his downfall. In 2000, Mr. Justice Gray found in Lipstadt's favour and further concluded that the Holocaust did indeed happen, involving mass gassing, and was carried out under direction from Berlin. Many people rallied round Lipstadt, and their defence team was able to outwit, out-argue, and outthink Irving. Irving did not come out of the trial well, but he was far from lacking in intellect and academic ability. Dangerous he might be, but he is the most notorious figure in a movement that seems to not go away. As mentioned earlier, I was once doing an internet search as I needed a swastika to use in the PowerPoint I was creating and chanced upon a Nazi website based in the US. This was really high up on the search too. Some of the blog comments were terrifying. A few years earlier, while searching for a book on Amazon, I came across a book denying the Holocaust. I was genuinely quite staggered by it. Upon reading the comments, someone had given it the lowest rating possible. I read their comments. They had said they had read it as they were interested in finding out how anyone can argue against the testimony of thousands of eyewitnesses and so much evidence in film and photograph. What they had discovered was that the people who were denying the Holocaust did not argue against the evidence, but ignored it entirely. They built up a selective narrative and slowly introduced doubt, similar to anti-vaxxers, Trump loyalists, Johnson loyalists. They prey on the notion of disbelief and construct a worldview that claims revisionism when looking at facts, but it is in fact presupposition and mind games. It is the ideology of superstition, fake news, conspiracy and alternative facts, of con artist trickery and quack medicine. It is the face of the used car salesman who has no qualms about selling short. It is deception and identity wrapped tight in a double helix of reptilian brain expression. Dare to be different. Dare to claim a position of omnipotent superiority. And in their eyes, who is to blame? The other. The Jews. The international Jewish conspiracy. The liberal elites. Multiculturalism. International finance capitalism. How truly simple and terrifying this mindset is. The sad truth of all is that since the financial crash of 2007-08, these ideas have become more acceptable and, dare I say it, mainstream. John F. Kennedy once spoke of the determination of the US to fight for liberty and freedom. And yet the leader of the free world as of October 2020 is an undisputed peddler of conspiracy theories that seem to defy even a sliver of rational consideration. Conspiracy is the word no one can argue with. For anyone who challenges the conspiracy theorist, whom I differentiate, by the way, from someone with critical thinking ability who can call out corruptions, lies, and vested interest, is accused of being in denial or part of the conspiracy itself. How easy a narrative. Who would have thought that 30 years after the victory of liberal democracy, often attributed to Fukuyama, that liberal democracy would be under threat to nativism, fear of the other, and racism? The lessons of 1945 and from the end of the Cold War, lost in a maelstrom of cruel nature amidst the failed promises of globalization. How quickly we forget, how easily even the Holocaust can be denied. Even the most rational of us, as psychoanalysts have proved, can be fooled by the passions of the crowd or the will of the majority group. The Holocaust is now. It is here among us, and to deny it is to deny the very nature of truth itself. It is to deny the transcendence that can come from learning the lessons of the past. Progress is difficult enough, even when we do not share some basic consensus. In a groundbreaking, outstanding documentary show by Claude Lanzmann, the opening scenes show a man in late middle age returning to the site at Chelmno, where he witnessed a mass burying of dead Jews. He is calm. The setting is pastoral and scenic. An opening in a forest. Yet here was where the first ghastly sight of repeated extermination took place. Trenches were dug, and vans arrived that had slowly and painfully murdered the inhabitants with carbon monoxide. The dead, naked, were gathered from the vans by workers who filled the trenches up in preparation for burning and burial. The death vans, first used against those with disabilities as part of the euthanasia program, were now deployed to kill Jews who had been kept locked in a church, stripped naked, and driven slowly to their death due to tubes connecting the exhaust system with the interior of the van. Systematic, resource-consuming, time-consuming, yet pathologically executed as part of the master plan. And the reason? As the death squads moved east, executing Jews and communists and others, the killers were psychologically affected. A more efficient way needed to be found. The efficient way was to be the death camps, extract labour and then kill. As mentioned earlier, this became pathological, and it also became bureaucratic and systematic. One wonders how much effort went into the final solution that might have been directed elsewhere. It became an obsession, a ritual. To the Nazi regime, it was to be defining. As mentioned earlier, when Hitler gave his final statement to his secretary before his suicide in May 1945, his key emphasis was about the Jewish problem as he saw it, and the failure of the German people to overcome their enemies. 65 million dead for an obsession. In the film The Eichmann Show, a drama about the famous trial, the reporter from the United States who travels to film the trial remarks that everyone is capable of Nazism. This can be viewed as similar to Arendt's conclusion on Eichmann. The idea that normal people can be taken along by something and were following orders as an argument that might be used to justify bad acts. I recall going back to Auschwitz one for a workshop about art and the Holocaust. We looked at some of the art done by camp survivors and by inmates, some of which was hidden underground. The intense ability to survive and find meaning impressed me so much. Some of the art was truly wonderful, and I recall a piece that showed an individual on their knees, and all about them was horror, skulls flying around in the air. It represented how the whole of reality can be truly seeped in evil. not only in the harshness of the camps and the guards and the horrors of gassing and experimentation that occurred there, but in the minds of those within who were destroyed, who saw in every morning creeping death and mental disintegration. Some of the stories of those who survived, Frankel and Levy, reveal how many found meaning in the day-to-day survival, the quest for hope and life. Frankel's superb book, Man's Search for Meaning, shows that we can find meaning in the darkest of times and how we must pursue it in the best of times too. That was the end of the formal part of the essay, but there was a few other things I just wanted to mention. There's a modern saying that once you mention Hitler or the Nazis, you've lost the argument, because it's an extreme example. But I don't think we should shy away from it, and I would challenge that notion. I think it is a valid argument. There's also an opinion on the left, or in criticising the left, that any move towards the left leads to Stalin and the camps of Stalinism and Maoism. There's also an argument used against the right that when the right achieve hegemony, that leads to Treblinka and the camps. That is oversimplistic, but we can still use the lessons from history and analyse these things in our day-to-day discussions, because it is relevant and it is important. I also found it interesting at the camps that there was many Jewish groups with Israeli flags, and also some Polish groups with Polish flags turning up at the camps. And for them it was a big thing about defying. And both of them seemed to come at it from different angles, which I found interesting. Also, there were many companies that benefited from the Holocaust, including Allianz, which is an insurance company which is still going today. And after the war, a lot of people who went along with Nazism, and in fact many fairly high ranking Nazis, were just kind of forgiven and allowed to reintegrate into post-war society, which was interesting. I also wanted to just mention how important it was to allow certain levels of forgiveness after the war. We know from the Iraq war that when they tried to destroy the Ba'athist state, the whole of society then collapsed. And to remove anyone who went along with Nazism, or to remove everyone from German society after the war, would have completely destroyed society. And I don't know whether that was the most favourable thing, but a lot of people, fairly high ranking types, did get away with it. And that's another ongoing debate. I read a great book called Inside Hitler's Bunker by Joachim Pest, which is not just about the Holocaust, it's about different historical interpretations of the war and to what extent the Holocaust was a product of the war, of Nazism, and of the kind of German approach to following orders. It's an interesting book to read in terms of that. After I'd wrote that essay in the summer of 2021, I read a book which finally gave me some deeper understanding of how the Holocaust happened. And it's a book called Ordinary Men, Reserve Police Battalion 101 and the Final Solution in Poland. And it's a fantastic book. You need to read it. After I read that book, I kind of got it, why it happened, a bit more than... It was written by Christopher Browning, and it just looks at the psychology of following orders and how these things happen. That book really did explain things and look at things in a way that I'd never heard before. And it's about an Einsatzgruppen death squad and how it operated in Poland and the psychology of it all. And it was a very good book that was very, very enlightening about how the Holocaust happened, and it gave me a psychological understanding of it, which I think other sources hadn't. I think I could read or write for 1,000 years and not get close to what actually happened, but this book showed the propaganda against the Jews beforehand. It shows that within all of us are monsters, that there was still individual choice in it all early on. Later the camp system took away individual choice, but there was still individual choice, and people opted to do it to save face, or because of groupthink or whatever, masculinity, I don't know. But that book is very good at looking at that. people can be capable of so much horror, but also of so much love and beauty. And we need to look at the amazing things humans can do positively when considering these kind of terrible events through history. One last thing I'll leave you with is, there was a guide, that guide who took us around Auschwitz, told us of the visitor to Auschwitz one time, and their father had been a soldier in World War II, and they said that their father didn't talk too much about what had happened during the Holocaust, and the son or daughter, I forget who it was now, what gender, saw his father or her father now dead on the picture doing the selections by the trains or assisting them. And after the war, this person had lived a completely normal life. So I'm going to leave you with that. Any criticisms or feedback, much appreciated. This is a deep topic, and I hope I've done it some justice. Not just as a historical event, but as an ongoing reality in the human condition. Thank you.